Hi, welcome to HolisticMatters.com podcast. It's the podcast that's designed to help you become the you that nature intended. Today, I'm excited about having a chance to talk about what I think is probably one of the most exciting and new topics across the healthcare industry and nutrition in particular. And we're going to talk about really two important things. One, the endocannabinoid system in the body that affects really virtually every major system and metabolic system in the body. And then as part of that, talk a little bit about hemp oil. To talk to us about that is a real leader and an innovator in the nutrition healthcare field. It's Carl Germano. He's been in this category for over 30 years and has been a real leader in both influencing the use of nutrition, growing the nutrition category, and specifically looking at new nutrition solutions. Carl, thanks for joining us. It's great to be able to talk to you again.
Thank you, Dr. Troop. It's a pleasure to be here.
There's so much interest right now across our category on hemp, and probably most people are not yet as familiar as I'm sure they will be in the next, you know, several months on the endocannabinoid system. And maybe we could start there first of all. Maybe you could describe to our listeners, what is the endocannabinoid system and why should we care about it?
Well, you are right in the sense that it's a very exciting time. Certainly, phytocannabinoids such as CBD and all the hype about hemp, and rightfully so, is dominating our industry and will continue to dominate it over the next decade or two. And I make that bold statement because of the importance of this physiological system that was discovered in the 1990s that has been somewhat ignored because of the stigma that is attached to cannabinoids. But that stigma is slowly on its way out as we are in the midst of a perfect storm of two colliding storms themselves, and that is the botanical travesty of the way hemp was first dumped into the definition of marijuana decades ago, which it should not have been there. And so the way it's been treated or mistreated. And secondly, the storm about the medical travesty of how we've ignored a physiological system that controls all others in the body because of that stigma. But thanks to Israel and thanks to Europe, who championed the research, that we cannot ignore this anymore. The history starts in the 1990s. It was an important decade of discovery. It was a decade that discovered, A, we have receptors in our body, and receptors are like little doorways that where information enters and elicits responses in the cell. But we have receptors for cannabinoids being active compounds in cannabis. And then the next thing that was discovered latter part of that decade was the fact that we produce compounds that attach, stimulate, or influence these cannabinoid receptors. So by the end of the 1990s, we discovered we produce two cannabinoids in our body. One is called anandamide, from the Sanskrit word ananda, meaning bliss. And the second one is 2-AG, which stands for 2-arachidonyl glycerol. So the first thing I tell the whole world, you're just going to have to get over it. You produce cannabinoids similar to cannabinoids found in cannabis. Your body feeds off of them, and without sufficient amounts, illness will ensue. As we are now looking at these cannabinoids as biological markers to determine whether we are sick or not, and to determine whether or not we produce certain types of illnesses, migraines, fibromyalgia, irritable bowel syndrome, neurological diseases, inflammatory conditions, and the list goes on and on. So, in a sense, while we understand all of these fragmented compartments in our body, physiological compartments, digestive system, cardiovascular system, immune system, on and on and on, right down in the middle, that's orchestrating all communication and influencing all functioning, is this endocannabinoid system, a massive series of receptors touching every organ and physiological function that is of utmost importance, that has been ignored, that cannot be ignored anymore.
Well, Carl, so this is pretty powerful. You got me really excited now. So now we're talking about real impact using really natural products to help manage this. But let's tease some of this apart now if we can. So if we talk about first the cannabinoid systems, they're, as we understand it, defined, that system is defined by really two types of receptors, CB1 and CB2. And which of those two plays a more important role, if either? Are they both important to maintain them in balance?
Sure. Early on, people were talking about how the cannabinoid receptor 1, or CB1, is primarily in the brain, and cannabinoid receptor 2, or CB2, primarily in the immune system. But what I call now, when we start to learn about cannabinatomy, is the fact that both CB1 and CB2 receptors are found everywhere. Yes, CB1 may be more concentrated in the brain and nervous system, and CB2 more concentrated in the immune system, but they're literally found every place throughout the body, and they both are extremely important. So our endocannabinoid system consists of cannabinoid receptors, CB1 and CB2, the cannabinoids that we produce in our body that attach to them to influence their functioning, anandamide and 2-AG, and then the enzymes that break down our cannabinoids. So, like nucleotides in our body, our cannabinoids are produced on demand, and they're broken down rapidly. And they're broken down by two interesting enzymes. One is called FA, or fatty acetamide hydrolase, and the other is called MAGL, or monoacylglycerol lipase. Now, the good news is we know that FA breaks down anandamide. And spoiler alert, one of the functions of CBD that's popular today, and trust me, CBD is a minor story. We'll get to that in a little bit. But one of the major functions of CBD is not that it attaches to CB1 and CB2 receptors. It interferes with the enzyme that breaks down anandamide. It interferes with FA, which means that the CBD helps to keep our endocannabinoid tone high, specifically for anandamide. Well, what about 2-AG? Well, 2-AG, what we have learned, is beta-amarin from Boswellia interferes with the MAGL enzyme that breaks down 2-AG. So CBD and Boswellia become very important in keeping the body's endocannabinoid tone levels high by interfering with the enzymes that break them down. And so while this amounts to what the endocannabinoid system is, CB1, CB2 receptors, the cannabinoids themselves, the enzymes that break them down, and certain compounds that are influencing those, we then look at what these anandamide and 2-AG, what these cannabinoids actually do, and where are they found? As I mentioned, they're found throughout the entire body. When they attach to the CB1 and CB2 receptors, they elicit very interesting effects, including regulated immunity, blood pressure, pain and inflammation, energy production in the cell, bone building by influencing osteoclasts and osteoblasts, neurotransmission in the brain, blood sugar by influencing insulin sensitivity. But anandamide and 2-AG are quite promiscuous in that they not only attach and influence CB1 and CB2 receptors, they also influence and attach to other receptors in the body, the TRP receptors that influence pain and inflammation, 5-HT3, which influences emesis and has analgesic effects in the body, PPAR receptors that reduce also pain and inflammation, protects the brain, gut, and heart, the GABA receptors that are sedative, muscle relaxing, anticonvulsive, anti-anxiety, and other receptors throughout the body. So these cannabinoids we produce are quite important, not only influencing and nourishing and supporting the endocannabinoid system, but other receptors that kind of overlap in their function with respect to their functionality. And when we look at the clinical applications of cannabinoids that we can give to patients and clients, that pain, inflammation, stress, anxiety, insomnia, ocular health, bone health, neurological health. These are the major categories of where phytocannabinoids become important factors factors as part of the nutritional arsenal we give patients. And quite frankly, we cannot treat any illness, disease, or condition unless we also influence, support, or nourish our endocannabinoid system. So these phytocannabinoids are going to become integral parts of all nutritional protocols treating almost every single disease. And when you say what's more important, CB1, CB2, they are both important. When we look at the neurological work that's been done, and there's many, many papers, we know that 2-AG reduces brain edema, cell death, and improves functional outcomes. We know anandamide also protects against brain injury. We know that both anandamide and 2-AG reduce inflammation, increase antioxidant protection, and reduce oxidative stress, the three hallmarks of all neurological diseases. So when it comes time to looking at this physiological system and looking at the receptors, we must understand that we really must address both CB1 and CB2 receptor support, because they do different things, they overlap in certain roles, but neither one can be ignored, and all the more reason why we look for products that have both CB1 and CB2 receptor right. support.
So, well, this is like really cool science, right? So let me ask you this. Let me ask you a series of short questions. Carl, so
sure.
First of all, the body has an endogenous source and supply of phytocannabinoids, anandamides, and 2-AG, right? So there's going to be compromised health conditions, right, where people don't make enough of this, which therein lies the issue of where you need exogenous sources and where hemp oil could be helpful in helping to supply the level of these compounds that you just described benefit as a result of having. Is that fair?
100%. There okay. is such a thing called endocannabinoid deficiency states,
right.
states where both either anandamide or 2-AG are too low, we don't produce enough, or for whatever reasons, and there are several reasons why we don't produce enough, and they are tied into several disease conditions.
Okay, cool.
That could be suitably treated by giving dietary phytocannabinoids.
Okay. And then the second mechanism, if you will, that you were describing is how these phytocannabinoids, especially the endogenous cannabinoids, can interfere with these enzymes, FAH and MAGO. But when they interfere in the enzymes, what are they doing? So they must be hindering the breakdown of these compounds into intermediates?
What happens is when you give exogenous compounds, say, for instance, CBD,
yeah.
one of the roles, and it plays several roles in the body, one of the roles of CBD plays is that it inhibits the enzyme FAH
yeah.
from breaking down anandamide. And the resulting effect is elevated anandamide levels, which is important.
Right, got it. Right.
And so, yeah.
Okay, so it's really stable, as you just said, it stabilizes the system so that it actually strengthens the availability of these compounds to influence these underlying systems.
Correct. And then when we look at the data on endocannabinoid deficiency states, it's not theoretical. This is real. Both anandamide and 2-AG are biological markers now for certain diseases. For instance, in a paper in Translational Psychiatry in 2014, they actually measured anandamide levels. When it got too low, it was a positive, statistically significant positive indicator for stress-induced anxiety. So when you have anandamide deficiency, a number of things can take place. Same thing with 2-AG. We look at some of the studies that they looked at brains of very challenged individuals, memory-challenged individuals, and you see an upregulation of CB2 receptors trying to protect the brain. So we now can use these cannabinoids we produce as biological markers. We can either give phytocannabinoids to improve their tone in the body by interfering the enzymes that break them down, or we can give phytocannabinoids to supplement the deficiencies of cannabinoids that we don't produce.
Right, okay. So that means that if you have a good level of these phytoactives, phytocannabinoids, and in particular 2-AG and anandamides, that means that they're available to then upregulate or appropriately regulate these cannabinoid receptors.
Absolutely, yes.
Downstream, that they're then able to control or influence these metabolic processes or responses that then lead to improved stabilization of any of the conditions that you were describing earlier.
Yeah, when you look at some of the functionality, that be hitting the CB1 and CB2 receptors, memory storage, motor function, posture, balance, thermal regulation, movement control, neuroendocrine release, immunity, nociceptive pain signaling to the brain, inflammatory cycling in the cell, bronchodilation in the lungs, intraocular pressure in the eye, bone building. I mean, the list just goes on and on. So while we can look down at the cellular level or at the organ level to see what these receptors and what these cannabinoids that we produce actually influence or govern their functionality, from a global perspective, what are we really looking at? We're looking at maintaining health, well-being, balance, what we call homeostasis.
Right.
And so from a global point of view, your endocannabinoid system regulates homeostasis. It's an adaptogenic system. But at the cellular and organ level, you can see this ECS functionality that occurs that really governs all physiological functioning in the body.
Okay. Now, I'm curious on the role that certain natural compounds might have on inhibiting some of these enzymes. So you mentioned Boswellia as an example, likely inhibits MAGO. But recently I saw some data by a group that showed a variety of natural products, herbs, plants, even foodstuffs, are able to activate the CB receptors. But I'm wondering how they do it. Like echinacea has been shown to be a non-specific CB1 and 2 activator. Carrots have been. But do you know anything about their mechanism? Are they interfering in this enzyme activity to preserve the level of these phytocannabinoids? Or are they just activating the receptors
right
in their own right?
Yeah, so we come to two things that we tell the world everybody's going to have to get over. One, you produce cannabinoids similar to cannabinoids found in cannabis. The second thing I tell people to get over is that they've been eating cannabinoids, carrots, hops, chocolate, echinacea, cloves, pepper, thyme, rosemary, marjoram, a lot of the spices. They contain naturally occurring phytocannabinoids. To date, there's only three plants where we've been able to commercialize and pull these cannabinoids out, in echinacea, in cloves, and in black pepper. While the others do contain phytocannabinoids, they're in there in minute amounts. So you would have to eat bushel loads to have really any clinical effect. Nevertheless, we've been able to pull out certain alkaloids from echinacea, and we've been able to pull out beta-caryophyllene from cloves and black pepper seeds, and beta-caryophyllene is a potent CB2 agonist, unlike most of the other cannabinoids found in hemp. By the way, beta-caryophyllene is found in hemp. It's one of the minor cannabinoids, but it's much richer, and we've been able to pull out this in high amounts in clove and black pepper. But, you know, the CB2 agonist activity there is enormous as it complements CBD's CB1 receptor support. Echinacea, it's got a alkaloid that is like a cannabinoid, and it influences anxiety in the body. But the others, while they're there in other foods, they're there in too small amounts to really have clinical benefit unless you extract them out in sufficient quantities. And
okay, but these other compounds like cloves, as an example, or black pepper, you wouldn't suggest, well, just take those and you don't have to take hemp oil. They must have some type
100%.
Of a synergistic or activation effect that doesn't replace the availability of phytocannabinoids, but support it.
No, 100% correct in that hemp is the richest source of phytocannabinoids, this class of which CBD is just one of over 100 phytocannabinoids. And so when you look at black pepper and cloves, I'm not looking at the standard, clove and pepper extracts out there in the marketplace. Special steam distillation techniques apply to these spices where you can pull out a cannabinoid that's normally in hemp, but much richer there. But beta-caryophyllene found in hemp, in clove, black pepper, is a CB2 agonist. It does nothing for the CB1 receptor. And so when you truly look at full support of the entire endocannabinoid system, you cannot beat hemp as the richest source of all the cannabinoids.
Right.
And this is important because out in the landscape out there, I know there are companies that have CBD isolates, these, you know, pharmaceutical drugs, which they are, which are nowhere near as effective as full spectrum oils that contain the full family of phytocannabinoids. And I emphasize this because for the longest time, we've been kind of fed misinformation that CBD is the only cannabinoid we need to be concerned about. Now, I make the analogy in botanical medicine that certainly there's this entourage effect that's very important, and that you need a lot more in the plant than just one single compound. And when we look at this, I tell people, you know, there's not one ginsenoside in ginseng. There's not one curcuminoid in curcumin. There's not one ginkgolide in ginkgo. There's not one isobutylamide in echinacea. So why are we focusing on just one phytocannabinoid in hemp when the whole family is important? And I can tell you that Dr. Ethan Russo said it best in the British Journal of Pharmacology in August of 2011, about the entourage effect of having all the family members present to give rise to full clinical meaningful benefit. Now, while CBD is the richest and most dominant phytocannabinoid in hemp, while the others are minor in number, they are not minor in effect in the body. And there is a paper published in Israel that went up against a full spectrum hemp oil versus a CBD isolate. And the full-spectrum hemp oil was superior in its clinical outcome. I even look at a paper that was published on looking at GW Pharmaceuticals' drug called Sativex up against patients who vaporize high CBD strains. And when you vaporize, you get a full entourage of the cannabinoids. And the vaporized group, again, having better clinical outcome. So we've learned something that we've known for the longest time in botanical medicine, that the whole family is needed to be there. And Dr. Raphael Michelum said it as well, that this type of synergism plays that role in the widely held view that in cases, plants are better agents than natural products that are isolated from them. And this is why we push for full-spectrum hemp oil extracts.
Right. Yeah, I think there's a lot of evidence to clearly support that across the board. Let's tease out, you know, the use of hemp oil for our practitioners who are listening today. You know, you described a whole list of issues, and I'm wondering if we might help our practitioners be more comfortable with when they should use it and for whom. So, you know, as an example, you talked about synergistic effect of different compounds that could can affect either the enzyme activation or the receptor activation. Recently, you know, another major system that was identified about 10 or 15 years ago at Harvard Medical School were the resolvent systems. And we now know that these lipid mediators that are pro-resolving share a receptor with anandamides. And that's pretty powerful if you look at the whole effect that that then has on the immune system and in particular the resolution of inflammation, and that's a new clinical paradigm. So would you think that maybe the starting point for practitioners to get comfortable with and more confident in this is to focus on an inflammation system, an immune response system, pain and inflammation in particular, that's worth pursuing as a starting point for patient care, or what do you think?
Sure. Well, before I get there, let me just say one thing. When you talk about resolvins, this brings to mind a very important and intimate relationship between the endocannabinoid system and omega-3 status. And it's very clear now that people who are omega-3 deficient, your endocannabinoid receptors are not as active, and a lot of those phospholipids are used as backbone structures to produce the cannabinoids in the body. So when we look at published data on people who are omega-3 deficient, we're seeing the same things, pain, inflammation, stress, anxiety, as we see in people who are endocannabinoid deficient.
Right.
And then take it a little bit further now, when we look at pain and inflammation, without a doubt, while curcumin, boswellia, quercetin, and fish oils are all potent anti-inflammatory agents. Well, we cannot address inflammation without looking at supporting the endocannabinoid system. In 2014, in the current opinion Clinical Nutrition Metabolic Care paper published on endocannabinoid system, the emerging key player in inflammation. And quite frankly, while all these other nutrients that we've been using in the past, which are very important, that enter these pathways, it is the endocannabinoid system that controls the pathways. They are intertwined with all the key processes that are involved in inflammation, including the eicosanoid pathways that both omega-3s and resolvins are involved in as well. So when it comes to inflammation, and it was said best in current papers in Neuropsychopharmacology and Advances of Pharmacology 2017 that looked at the ECS as the target for addressing inflammatory and neuropathic pain, and looked at the sites and the mechanism of action. They talked all about how from opioids to NSAIDs have issues with their limitations, adverse effects, and tolerance and dependence, and on and on and on. And then went on to talk about the analgesic anti-inflammatory effects of the cannabinoids, including neurotransmitter release, inhibiting pain pathways, reducing inflammatory signaling, on and on and on, with a whole host of other compounds, including resolvins. So if you are going to address pain and inflammation conditions, you must support the endocannabinoid system. And so phytocannabinoids, along with omegas, resolvins, curcumin, boswellia, quercetin, these are the accessory nutrients to the phytocannabinoids to really be effective and have a much better clinical outcome for patients.
Is it fair also to look at, you know, the advantage of phytocannabinoids and part of the endocannabinoid system, that overall the importance on all systems, and in particular inflammation, like if you look at inflammation as a two-stage process, initiation of inflammation and the resolution of inflammation, the endocannabinoid system and the phytocannabinoids in particular really help that full continuum, the two stages, whereas some components like curcumin may only affect one of those stages, but not to the same degree and magnitude that the phytocannabinoids themselves can do. I mean, is that fair? I mean, hemp oil is really much more powerful. And so given a choice, use hemp oil, but for even better, use combination therapies, but know that the combinations you're using are targeting only one piece, not the overall strength of the system that the phytocannabinoids do.
Absolutely. And I've, for the past 3.5 decades, in both clinical practice and in product development, I've never been a proponent of single magic bullet approach. Even as important as cannabinoids are, as important as the endocannabinoid system is, I always look for accessory compounds that are synergistic or complement what we are doing here. And without a doubt, the cannabinoids, whether the endocannabinoids or the phytocannabinoids we supply through hemp oil, while we know they can inhibit excitatory neurotransmitter release involved with nociceptive pain signaling on that signaling pathway, then down at the cell, inhibiting the actual pain pathway and reducing inflammatory signaling at the cell, that's like no other compound out there. And yes, you're right that things like curcumin and all these other accessory nutrients have only one or maybe two overlapping roles, but without a doubt, the phytocannabinoids and hemp really govern the entire process and work very much in a complementary role to these secondary nutrients. So I'm all for multiple component system approach here with using hemp oil and other compounds. And so if it's for inflammation, yes, I want boswellia there, I want curcumin there, I'd like quercetin, maybe some fish oils, without a doubt. That would make a perfect a protocol. If I was dealing with anxiety, yeah, L-theanine, lavender, chamomile, and there's a whole host, GABA, what have you, on and on. So you get the picture that hemp oil would sit at the base foundation of these formulations and then you enter in with the secondary accessory nutrients that complement its role.
Okay. So both mechanistically and from the level of evidence clinically in the literature and other research projects, you make a strong case for the use and or co-therapy of hemp oil for pain and inflammation, the immune response, stress and anxiety, the central nervous system, and pain associated with that as well. What would be the second tier of indications that you'd make as strong of a case for?
Right. Well, just quickly to kind of complete the pain and inflammation story is also at the gut, you know, in this, brain-gut immune connection, where we now know in gastroenterology 2016, the endocannabinoid system and the brain-gut axis, where it not only controls gut motility and emesis, but also intestinal inflammation, abdominal pain, and reduces the activity of the HPA pathway. So there's some remarkable stuff going on there. Then in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences in 2017, they kind of revealed how anandamide plays pivotal roles in immunological health in the gut and how the ECS regulates, again, inflammation-induced disruptions of permeability in the gut as well. So I want to just kind of complete there. Getting to the next category, after pain and inflammation, stress and anxiety are right behind it, if not right aside of it. There is a number of papers that look at animal models, healthy human volunteers, and even people with social anxiety disorders of how these phytocannabinoids in hemp have anxiolytic-like effects and can treat clinical social anxiety disorders. In the Journal of Basic Clinical Physiological Pharmacology in 2016, they did a synopsis of targeting the ECS to address stress-related challenges. They looked at both preclinical and clinical data, noting that stress-related challenges are associated with not only neurotransmission, but also with decreased endocannabinoid tone in the body. And then we look at very specific studies, like in Translational Psychiatry 2014, how central anandamide deficiency predicts stress-induced anxiety. So again, as I mentioned earlier, how anandamide and 2-AG become biological markers that we can look at when the levels get too low, we know that it can trigger and predict certain disease conditions, and in this particular case, stress-induced anxiety. Without a doubt, when you look at combination therapy, take a look at curcumin. There's a great paper in Cellular Physiological Biochemistry 2017 targeting the endocannabinoid system, CB1 receptor system, for treating major depression through the antidepressant activities of curcumin. And what did this study reveal? That curcumin improved CB1 expression, and besides doing other things in the brain for greater dopamine and hydroxytryptamine release. So you could see that there is significant data out there on stress, anxiety, depression, and then we look at the papers with vets with post-traumatic stress disorder. How not only are we dealing with the neurotransmitters involved with the stress pathways, but also the extinction of aversive memories that cause chronic stress in these individuals that leads to physiological collapse for them. So I would say right behind pain and inflammation is stress and anxiety.
Great. Let me ask you this question. You know, more and more as practitioners are becoming just newly aware of hemp oil, there seems to be, you know, really, as you kind of alluded to, but maybe you could give us a little bit more insight, this confusion on, you know, is it marijuana, is it hemp oil? And then where this becomes even a more critical issue and concern is that state licensure boards and associations across many professions, you know, clinical professions, healthcare professions, are suggesting the use of hemp oil might even be out of scope. But we know with all the science that you've just been talking about that's not a fair assessment, and it seems that it's probably more related to this lack of understanding of hemp versus marijuana. Can you give us some insights on what you think about that?
So it's important to make a complete distinction and differentiation between hemp and marijuana. From a botanical standpoint, both are the same genus and species, Cannabis sativa. And that's where the similarity ends. Marijuana has been cultivated for its primary phytocannabinoid called THC, tetrahydrocannabinol, that we know has recreational value, but we also know in small amounts it has tremendous medical value as well. Nevertheless, THC is still a drug. Marijuana has its issues, and we're watching prohibition across the states. Whatever, we're going to put that to the side because that is a different plant than hemp. Hemp has been cultivated for many reasons for thousands of years. Food, clothing, fiber, fuel, and it looks very different than marijuana. Marijuana being a short, squattier plant with broad, wide leaves. Hemp has these 8 to 12 foot stalks and stems with narrow, broad, narrow, thin leaves. But in the plant, there are these active compounds called phytocannabinoids. And when you look at hemp, hemp, genetically speaking, has little to no THC. And so from a botanical standpoint, the plants have been cultivated for very different reasons, and hemp should never have been placed into the definition of marijuana, which it was done over 70 years ago. Nevertheless, in 2014, the Food Farm Bill was passed, and it finally distinguished and differentiated hemp from marijuana. It was called the Agricultural Act of 2014. It clearly stated that hemp is cannabis sativa, but it has less than 0.3% THC on a dry weight basis, so little to no THC that could be intoxicating. Then we know that there have been legal precedents about how hemp is a food. In 1994, Clinton signed an executive order to stockpile agricultural products for national security purposes. Hemp and all its oils are in there. Then we know that there is the hemp oil is listed on the U.S. Harmonized Tariff Schedule as a federally legal import. No restrictions on CBD content, but as long as it doesn't have more than 0.3% THC. So for the longest time, we've had hemp stigmatized because it was dumped into the definition. And since 2014, things started to get a little bit easier. Even from the DEA's standpoint, under the Controlled Substances Act that kind of defines compounds that are intoxicating, that are most dangerous to human beings, includes heroin, LSD, mescaline, methaqualone, psilocybin, on and on. And even marijuana was unfortunately placed in there, which will change in time. But under that Controlled Substances Act, in the final ruling, DEA stated clearly that CBD products derived solely from the stalks of industrial hemp containing little to no THC are not prohibited under the marijuana extract rule, even though it's not marijuana. So we never had an issue necessarily with DEA. It's what you exactly said before, that we've had this misunderstanding by states, and when they get challenged, suddenly that gets dismantled, that there is no prohibitive aspects to hemp under the Controlled Substances Act that DEA regulates. Now, everybody's waiting for Senator Mitch McConnell's bill called the Hemp Farming Act of 2018 to get passed, which we hear is getting passed any day now. And what this bill will finally do is take the term hemp completely out of the Controlled Substances Act, meaning that it's going to finally dismantle and deregulate hemp entirely, even though, again, DEA says it's not prohibited anyway. But this bill will finally do that. This bill will also give U.S. farmers the ability to grow and cross state lines commercially with the material.
Wow. Carl, so you've provided an incredible depth of knowledge and insight today. And fortunately, you have a book coming out in January called The Road to Ananda, a guideline to health using the phytocannabinoids. What is the exact title? It's a kind of a long subheading title, but maybe you could share that with the audience. So I think that after listening to this podcast, you know, our listeners are going to want to go get your book.
Yeah, the title of the book is called Road to Ananda. And as I spoke about it early on, Ananda is the Sanskrit word that means bliss. And Ananda was used to call and characterize the first cannabinoid that was discovered we produced in our body called anandamide. And why they used ananda, which means bliss in Sanskrit terms, to a cannabinoid produced in the body, is because anandamide hits the CB1 receptors. These are the same receptors that THC hits that causes intoxication. So while anandamide is not as strong as THC, it is responsible for the runner's high. And so it causes a mild euphoria, so to speak, when levels are elevated. So Road to Ananda is the title, and the subtitle is The Simple Guide to the Endocannabinoid System, Hemp Phytocannabinoids, and Your Health. And I'm quite excited because I have the person who actually discovered the endocannabinoid system who will be writing the short, and that is Dr. Raphael Michel.
Fantastic. And that'll be available on our own website, Holistic Manners, by the end of January. So we'll invite our listeners to check us out, as well as a number of other articles on hemp oil. Carl, this is the third time we've had a chance. You've given two presentations for us and this podcast, and every time I have to say that at least I, and I'm sure our listeners and participants at the seminars who listen to this, will have learned something new. So it's so exciting to talk to you and to further advance this new innovative nutritional natural product that you've identified and brought to the market, and with all the great supporting science. So thanks very much for your time. It's always a pleasure talking to you, and look forward to talking to you again and seeing you at a seminar soon.
Thank you, Dr. Shoup. It was a pleasure to be here.
All right. Thanks very much.
This podcast features the song New Day by Lee Rosevere, licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution License. If you like this podcast, please share with your friends and family. And don't forget to subscribe on iTunes. We'll see you next time on Holistic Matters, where we're talking about being the you that nature intended.